Hello, Narnie Webbers. This is Glumpuddle.
And I'm really in. Hello.
And we're reading C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Why should we not come to the very eastern end of the world? And what might we find there? I expect to find Aslan's own country. It is always from the east, across the sea, that the great lion comes to us. I say, that is an idea, said Edmund in an awed voice.
This is my favorite book.
You don't say.
I'm not saying that it's going to go downhill from now on. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying the discussion's going to be lacking.
So not just,
however,
not just favorite Narnia book, but favorite book, right?
Well, it is my favorite Narnia book, although I would easily... Ooh, that's a good question. I would certainly put it in my top 10 works of fiction.
It's my favorite book of all time, period.
Wow.
I'll tell you, I've been listening to it. Man, is it such a relief to be doing this for real and not, like, sarcastically? Like,
I've repented many times.
Yeah, we have to, make up for our sins right now. But the thing I've been noticing listening to it on CD recently in the car, I've been doing a lot of driving recently, is, like, I think that all the Narnia books have little things that are so easy to forget, and you read it again, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot that little bit. And I think that Dawn Treader has more little things than any of the other books in the series, and just like little lines that are so easy to forget, little throwaway lines, little references, and I think that's the reason why it took me three readings of the series to decide it was my favorite book. First time I read the series, favorite was Silverchair. Second time it was
Ditto.
Last Battle.
Silverchair used to be my favorite book.
First time I read the series, Silverchair was my favorite. Second time it was Last Battle. Third time I finally realized it was Dawn Treader. But I think the reason is because it's one of those things where there's a lot of books and movies and stories where you forget how good it is until you actually go back and take another look. Like, you'll tell people, oh yeah, that's my favorite movie. But then you watch it again, like, wow, it's really good. I forgot just how good it is. Like, there's just something in your... So there's something about Dawn Treader that kind of fades from your emotional memory. I don't know, just because all the little things, I guess. Then you read it again, it's like, wow, this is really awesome. And so I think that's why it took me three readings to finally figure out Dawn Treader was actually my favorite.
It contains some of the best writing is part of it. I'm not saying that... You know, there's just some moments... When you go back to... just in memory, I think if you ask any diehard fan being someone who's read it, the Chronicles multiple times, say, hey, what little descriptions stood out to you the most? You know, little things like that. They're going to say things like, wow, you know, the description of the earth coming to life in the Magician's Nephew, that's going to be one of them. First sight of the lamppost is probably going to be one of those things that just kind of sticks with you. But then if you were to keep asking people, they're probably, if they're going to, my guess is, well, you know, for me, if I were to list out every single one of the little vivid descriptions or little my favorite portions of writing, more of them are going to be in Dawn Treader than in any other book. Things that I loved reading about, like the Three Sleepers. It could be the brilliant, my favorite portion of writing, just from a narrative standpoint, where Caspian sets the slaves free. You know, it could be the introduction to the book. You know, I'll never forget the opening line. I could
best opening ever.
Come close to quoting the opening line of some of the other books, but it's certainly the best opening line for any book ever. This the opening line by itself, and I'll just go ahead and read it since we're talking about the beginning. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him.
It's just like just that one line right there is so hilarious. Yeah. Because first off, it's a funny line in itself. And the first two books, Wardrobe and Caspian, have both opened with, once there were four children whose names are Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. It's so completely different from the other openings and not what you expect. And it takes Lewis, I think, it takes him a few paragraphs here to actually tell you what this Eustace guy's relation is to the Pevensey. So he's just this Eustace character who has a terrible name. That's all we know about him. It just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's a bit that C.S. I think was very personal to C.S. to Clive Staples Lewis, who hated his name. Which is the reason why it was always called Jack. So I think that's something that, and notice that he almost deserved it. Like even Clive Staples can relate to Eustace hating his name, saying, "Look, even Eustace Clarence Scrub doesn't deserve to have a name like that." So this is something that C.S. Lewis, aka Jack Lewis, could really relate to.
And I love the very just some things that are just sort of an open-handed slap in the face of political correctness of the day. They were up to date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes.
Now, all the Narnia books do begin with the first page or two is always just a setup of here's an environment, here's a place, here's a thing, you know, in wardrobe, it's just here's their situation, you know, World War II being sent away to this professor's house. In Prince Caspian, it's, you know, that they're now they're going back to school and they're all a little depressed about that. In The Silver Chair, we'll see just an introduction to Jill Pohl and her situation. Yeah. It's almost like a little prologue. And in here, it's just a lot of details about what kind of character Eustace Clarence is, which we will obviously see him change over the course of the story.
Eustace is in his comfort zone. Pevensey's are not. And then a couple pages later, you've got a complete switcheroo. And you know, there's little things like that just that I just love, and it's kind of neat just seeing the characters, you know. Eustace is at his worst in his environment. The Pevensies are kind of at their worst
yeah.
in their environment, too.
What better example of that than our first question? We have been accepting questions from Narnie Webbers, and, you know, if you want to send in a question about Voyage of the Dawn Treader, please send it to rillian@narnieweb.com and or glumpuddle@narnieweb.com. But, well, not so much a question as an observation here is Andrew just mentions, you know, Eustace's reaction to the painting of the ship versus Lucy's reaction. Lucy sees it and it captures her imagination. And she imagines, no, it looks like the ship's really moving and the waves are really moving up and down. And Eustace sees it and says that it's a rotten picture.
You have him here, he's looking at this painting, and he's looking at, okay, it's a painting, it's paint. Lucy's actually looking at the painting, and she's trying to look at it for meaning. What does Ramandu say to Eustace once, when he's talking about stars? He says, well, in our world, the star is a huge ball of flaming gas. He says, well, even in our world, even in your world, that's not what a star is. That's only what it's made
exactly.
of.
Exactly. So I think Eustace sees this, and he just sees a painting, wood and paint.
Eustace is looking at the material. He can't see anything beyond meaning. You know, he could look at a sign and tell you every component of what makes up the sign without telling you what the sign reads.
Yeah. And so Eustace fails to, you just see in the kind of books he reads and the kind of things that, you know, says that he was interested in books of information, which is something we got a question about. And we'll talk about it, you know, probably in the next podcast about Eustace having read the wrong sort of books. And so he's going to get thrust into a world where none of that does him really any good at all. Like you said, out of his comfort zone. And we really see him go out of his comfort zone where he's staring at the ship and mocking it and making fun of it. And suddenly it comes to life and makes him sick, of course. So what, yeah.
And I have to ask you, because we mocked this to death in the non-podcast, but what do you think of the way that they're transported? In some ways, I don't know if, I'll just put it this way. It's hard, this, of any of the methods of transportation to the other world, this is the one where it's hardest for me to decide if I like or dislike.
Well, I think it's definitely the one that stands out the most. It's not like, it's the first one that's not explained at all. There are others, like the one in the Silver Chair, the way they get to Narnia is never fully explained. But, you know, they go through the wardrobe, and we don't, you know, really understand why the wardrobe works. But later in Magician's Nephew, Lewis eventually explains it. Caspian, they get pulled off that platform. We don't know why, but eventually it's explained. And here we have one where it's never explained. Presumably, this is one of the... Now, Aslan did say at the end of Prince Caspian that there were many... Well, I think he was talking about there are many chinks and chasms between our world and this world, and I think this has to be one of the chinks and chasms. So, and like, you know, in some of these we've been given backstory, and some of them we haven't. But you have to assume, based since we've already had one, like the one in Prince Caspian, well, why are they pulled off that platform? Well, Trumpkin will tell you, and it's a long, involved, layered backstory to explain why they were pulled off that platform and what caused Caspian to blow that horn. So here, we're not getting an explanation, but we can assume that it's probably a really interesting, layered story. So that's what gives... He has explained enough to where the things he doesn't explain, like we've talked about, have extra depth, and you feel like there's something there, even if Lewis doesn't explain it. So you have to wonder, you know, maybe if we were going to... You know, we always talk about... things it would have been interesting to see Lewis write a book about. Where did this picture come from? Who was that relative that they didn't?
Yeah, I know. How did they get a picture of Narnia?
This was given to them by a relative that Aunt Alberta did not want to offend. Had this person been to Narnia before? Maybe, is that possible? Or where did they get it? And it immediately suggests so much backstory. It just tickles my imagination.
One thing I will say is just as I think about, because I'm comparing it to all the, or contrasting it to the other entrances into Narnia, in many ways, this is the most, it's the most magical. And I'm holding out air quotes, man. I hate air quotes. Like the Magician's Nephew is almost science fiction. How they get into the different world. I mean,
More so than the other books, yeah, at least.
it's almost like a science fiction. In some of the books, it's more of a clear doorway. It's almost a like Stargate,
This is
you know,
probably
just.
the most vague of the way of the entrances into Narnia, where it's not clear, like, is the picture getting bigger? Are they
It
getting
is kind
smaller?
of vague, but I remember it was one of the hardest to imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the hardest to kind of visualize, I think, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're on board the Dawn Treader, and I mean, right away you just know this is going to be different, as if the opening with Eustace didn't already clue you in.
Right.
They're on a ship in the middle of nowhere. Okay, we know this book is going to be really different from the first two, and you know we're reintroduced to Caspian kind of briefly, and then, but more importantly, I think we have one of the more memorable character introductions in the series, and really it's a reintroduction, but it feels like he's
It
being
is re
introduced.
I was going to say
Yeah,
reintroduction.
but I always kind of remember this as his introduction because, you know, Reepicheep, he's not given much of an introduction in Prince Caspian, and in Prince Caspian, he really is. He's not that much like I said in the podcast. He's not that much more than what the Bulgy Bear is. You know, just oh, it's a bear who sucks his paws. That's funny. Oh, it's a mouse that fights. That's really funny. And I do think it's interesting that Lewis feels the need to reintroduce him here. I think you can almost sense right away. Number one, Lewis is planning on doing more with this character and giving him more depth. And number two, he's spending a lot of time on him because he's going to play a much more important role in this book. But the way I absolutely, and I think this combined with the Pauline Baynes illustration,
Yeah.
is such a great
Yeah.
introduction.
Now I think that Reepicheep is it's interesting that Lewis brings him in because in some ways he is the most Narnian part of this voyage.
What do you mean?
Well, yes, you have Caspian, but you know Caspian came from our world. You have it's like you have the Telmarines on the ship. It's like Reepicheep embodies so much of what is good about Narnia. And I'm not trying to trivialize his character saying, well, he's just symbolic of what's good about Narnia. But having him on the ship provides so much of what, for instance, you know, the book doesn't take place in Narnia. The book takes place on the Eastern Seas. And having him there, especially with this character being who he is, you have that goodness, that nobility, that readers just sort of associate with memories of Narnia, the Golden Age, and he is almost like a little piece out of the Golden Age too. There are so many moments where I'll talk about his
We'll
great
get to
little
them.
moments as they come.
We could go on and on and on about Reepicheep, and
I
we
could,
will.
but
He's the character we'll probably talk about the most. Hell, him and Eustace are the two characters we'll talk about the most. But I love the. And another thing about Reepicheep, he is in just about every way imaginable the opposite of Eustace. And just obviously the fact that
That's a
he's a
good
talking
point.
animal, something Eustace didn't believe in a moment ago. And he just. Everything he stands for, you know, honor, chivalry, you know, humility. So
Humility?
it could not be more different than Eustace, which is why it's hardly surprising when Eustace sees him and
Yeah.
freaks out.
Now I was just thinking, I kind of contradict you there for a second, but I disagree with myself. You said he represents humility, and I'll just give this little glow about Reepicheep.
Well, what I meant by humility, I guess, is
Well, but
that.
no, let me talk though, because I'm just thinking about it. Because in many ways, he is actually humble, because he puts things before himself. Because a lot of times in our culture, we think about humility as being just self-deprecating, and that's all it is. And he's not that. But yeah, he is someone who is selfless and puts others before himself.
Yeah,
He has his self-respect, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't have humility.
that's
That's a
funny.
good
When
point.
you first started saying that, actually, I was almost kind of wanting to take it back a little bit and redefine humility, but he's not full of himself necessarily. You know, he
No.
has a lot of, I think, a lot of self-confidence, but
Self-respect, self-confidence,
yeah,
yes.
he puts his king, his country, he puts a lot of things before himself. And so
Aslan.
yeah, absolutely. So you actually you could call re
He
I'm
never takes credit where credit is not due.
uh-huh
He never takes anyone else's
Eat, sleep, die for his king are the three things he mentions as being most important to him in Prince Caspian. So it's funny, initially you kind of think of him as being full of himself, but if you really read it, that's not true. Sri Patip is actually one of the more humble characters in the series.
He really is.
Wow, I never quite thought of it that way. But
good job, Glumfuddle.
Yay, discovery.
We just learn something new every day.
So then we start getting into explaining what the whole point of this voyage is, and just sort of setting up the rest of the book, basically.
And it does kind of bring up maybe a good question also that we got earlier from Andrew. He said, do you think it is irresponsible of Caspian, his kingdom Narnia, to leave his kingdom and go off on a long sea voyage? Because we learn he's decided to reclaim, to go after the seven lords that his uncle had banished. And they
asked this question. You know, Lewis does kind of address this. Edmund asks Caspian, is all going well? Mm-hmm. And Caspian says, you don't suppose I would have left my kingdom and put to sea unless all was well, answered the king. Oh, it couldn't be better. There's no trouble at all now between Telmarine, dwarves, talking beasts, fauns, and the rest. So we know that Narnia is at peace.
Yeah. And then they have a regent, Trumpkin, the dwarf.
Yeah. Who is there in his place. And actually, I think that, like, you're just talking about how this whole book is not a major component of this book is about fixing something that what we learned was wronged in Prince Caspian. So I actually believe that this is the responsible thing Caspian is doing. He's actually taking responsibility for his uncle's actions and vowing to make them right again.
Just thinking about this, it's hard to imagine any kind of... you think about what they did. They built a ship from scratch, basically. He had to rebuild the navy, he says. And you think about all the expense and the personal risk he's taking and what he's doing, and it's really for the sake of honor. Uh-huh. And not a high and lofty, honor.
There's really nothing he stands to gain, really.
Yeah, it's altruistic, and it's not just him, but it's all of his men. And I think one reason I love it is because I think it's foreign today, and I think it was foreign in Lewis's day. A lot of readers, it's hard for them to imagine a leader of their country going out, taking personal risk to do something like this. You know, I'm not trying to slam world leaders across the globe, but just think about it. It is a foreign concept that we grow up with, to think that someone would do this, put up this risk, this expense, for the sake of honor, for the sake of correcting a wrong.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's something that, you know, that's what he did on his coronation day. I guess that was one of the first things he did. He said, "On my coronation day, with Aslan's approval, I swore an oath that once I established peace in Narnia, I would sail east myself for a year and a day to find my father's friends, or to learn of their deaths and avenge them if I could." It's becoming more rare to find characters in fiction that do things just because it's the right thing to do. It seems like more often they have to be sort of not quite tricked into it, but have some kind of something to kind of get them on that road before they start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, enough about the Seven Lords. Obviously, yes, that's the reason they set out, and that's important to Caspian, why he's doing this. But for me, what really drives this book is what Caspian refers to as a higher hope. He says that Reaper Chief has an even higher hope. And Reaper Chief says, "As high as my spirit, though perhaps as small as my stature, why should we not come to the very eastern end of the world? And what might we find there? I expect to find Aslan's own country. It is always from the east, across the sea, that the great lion comes." "I say, that is an idea," said Edmund in an awed voice. "This is the thing that really captures my imagination, of the world having an end and it being Aslan's country and what that would look like. We've heard about the emperor over the sea. Which you never actually hear about again. But though we've heard about Aslan coming we've heard about Aslan coming from over the sea. And I think it's interesting how we've heard about that, and it sounded kind of vague and sort of
over the sea.
Yeah, but here it's like, oh, we're literally going over the sea, and what are we going to find? And that really captures my imagination.
Yeah, and I think one of the parts that I remember, I mean, there's some moments that I just remember as a small kid reading, you know, or my dad reading, and I just remember kind of the eye-opening line of dialogue where, I mean, this is kind of jumping ahead, but where he used to say, well, the world is a ball. It's a globe. And Eustace said, well, our world is, but is this? And I remember thinking, I never asked that question when I was thinking about Narnia. I mean, really, as I was reading the different books and stuff, I never thought about, oh, This world, it may not be round. Just things like that. I love that Lewis just kind of throws in there, oh, you didn't consider that? Why did you, why such a hasty generalization, why did you assume?
Now, as much as I obviously love this part of the book, Arepy Chief is explaining that this has been his heart's desire for his entire life, basically, there is a potential inconsistency here.
Say it.
There is this. Reaper Chief says, "When I was in my cradle, a wood woman, a dryad, spoke this verse over me. Where sky and water meet, where the waves grow sweet, doubt not, Reaper Chief, to find all you seek. There is the utter east." So he says, a wood woman, a dryad, spoke this verse over him when he was in his cradle. But I thought they'd been asleep for, centuries.
Huh.
During Prince Caspian, haven't they been asleep for a long
time? Yes.
I'm jumping back to Prince Caspian here. Where Truffle Hunter's talking to Caspian and says, if only we could wake the spirits of these trees. Caspian says, can't we? And Truffle Hunter says, no, we have no power over them. Since the humans came into the land, felling forests and defiling streams, the dryads and naiads have sunk into a deep sleep. Who knows if they will ever stir again? And here you have Reaper Chief saying that a wood woman, a dryad, spoke this verse over him.
I guess you could say, well, maybe that particular dryad, maybe there was no felling near her tree at that time.
But there are ways out of this. Maybe this was a dream Reaper Chief had. And regardless, it's sort of remarkable that he would be able to remember something from when he was in his cradle. So maybe it could be that his parents or somebody who was present told him that this happened. Or it could be that maybe a dryad basically woke up, gave this prophecy, and then fell asleep again, which would make that... which Truffle Hunter can't be expected to remember or know. There are ways to plug the plot hole, but Lewis never makes an effort to do it.
Yeah.
Regardless, the important thing here is that Reaper Chief has been longing for this his entire life, since he was in his cradle. He says the spell of it has been on me all my life. That's something, and that's going to inform so much of how Reaper Chief behaves, especially towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
But finally we reach land, the Lone Islands. We kind of jumped on this journey. We kind of missed the beginning of the journey, but so we've been on the Dawn Treader this entire time. Now we're coming to the Lone Islands, which has a sort of an air of mystery about it because they haven't been there in a long time.
Yeah.
And there's even more of an air of mystery. We reference this a lot when we're talking about examples of use of Lewis teasing things, giving you the sense of depth. Just in parentheses, he says, by the way, I have never yet heard how these remote islands became attached to the Crown of Narnia. Mm-hmm. If I ever do, and if the story is at all interesting, I may put it in some other book.
I love that.
Which he eventually does in the last battle. He kind of briefly mentions, how that's happened. So we'll get to that.
He writes these as histories. And they're actually little history books, He writes these as if he's writing about things that happened.
So these things happened, and Lewis doesn't necessarily have all the details.
Yeah, which is great.
I really like how, one of the things we see throughout this book is, as Water Kid mentions, in an email question, just mentions that, how Caspian's maturing. But how we see Caspian's maturity throughout this book, and Caspian makes the decision to walk across Felimath, and of course that's how meet the Dawn Treader on the other side. And Lewis writes, if Caspian had been as experienced then as he became later in the voyage, he would not have made this suggestion. But at the moment, it seemed like an excellent one. So I like the fact that Lewis is saying, yeah, Caspian's not perfect. He's going to make mistakes occasionally. I like the acknowledgement there.
I actually like that he says that kind of for another reason. Really, because there's so many times where you read a book, you think, why did you have them do this? It's like, really? You had them do this? And Lewis is kind of saying, why did you do this? He's inexperienced, and it wasn't a very good idea. And that's why he did it,
But then Caspian gets a little bit smarter, because he chooses not to tell them that he's the King of Narnia when they get captured. And we really have our first adventure here, our first thing where our lives of our characters are in danger. So helps kind of kickstart the story a little bit.
And it's sort of interesting how I love how there's no way to predict how Caspian will find each of the seven lords.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that's so interesting. And even after the first two, you meet one, and then you meet the second one, and you think, oh my goodness, these are completely different. There's no way of telling. It's not like, oh, Caspian went to this island and met this man and this house, and it was this lord. And then he went to another island that was these three men in this house, and it was those three lords. And it's nothing like that. But I love that it just kind of takes you by surprise. Oh, Well, why not? Why couldn't it? You have had one who just
Right,
decided, you know what,
the
I'm
way
not going to say that
Burned,
anymore.
the way Lord Byrne just pops up, and we, of course, we don't know it's Lord Byrne initially, it's just this random guy. And initially, and I'd be curious if people could post a comment. Did anybody here guess that it was one of the seven lords? I know that I didn't.
I didn't.
I just thought, oh, it was just this guy. And it seemed like a bad thing. Oh, no, Caspian's being bought and taken
Well,
away. That's
especially
probably a
because the
bad
adventure
thing.
hasn't really begun yet.
Right. Like Reaper Cheap says, it's after the Lone Islands the adventure really begins. I love the way. So initially, it seems like it's a bad thing. Caspian's getting taken away, and it gets turned around into not only is it a good thing, it's actually solving, one of the part of the plot here, basically. We found one of our seven lords. And Caspian's initial idea, his initial solution to the problem of the fact that, okay, I'm free, but the rest of my friends are enslaved, seems like probably the same solution most readers have in their minds. Caspian says, "Shall we not have my ship in and fall upon Pug and free my friends whom he holds captives?"
Yeah, which would be the
And
obvious
that's
thing
what
to
you're
do.
expecting.
Yeah, and it's like that's obvious. Well, that's not necessarily a good idea either.
Right. And it's absolutely what you're expecting to happen. And Byrne has a much better idea, which is to put on this, and this is what, to put on this little show, basically, and pretend like they have more ships than they do, which is so much more interesting.
Yeah.
And the fact that Caspian is actually able to do it,
Yeah.
is able to pull it off, is really cool. And going back to what a Water Kid 27, the little observation he sent in about Caspian's maturity. But Water Kid writes that the scene is so brilliantly performed, and I love what Water Kid 27 says, where he says that it really shows that the fact that you can feel anxiety about this scene without any real physical confrontation or action scene makes the scene really, really, really memorable. It's not at all what you're expecting. It's more about, oh my gosh, are they going to figure out that Caspian is totally doesn't actually have all these ships, and it's actually really vulnerable. That's where the
Well,
tension comes from.
it's in some ways it's the only way to have tension, because what do you have to do if you're going to have an action scene? What's at risk? I mean, really? Okay, so if there's an action scene, are Lucy, Eustace, and Edmund gonna die? No. So that tension's kind of removed for the reader, you know? Of course, if there were a fight, well, we know who would win. It would just be obvious because, well, they're the good guys, and the reader would just kind of fill that in and provide that kind of cushion. So I think, because the question here is, oh, this is their plot. This is how they're going to escape without any kind of fighting or without any risk themselves. Will it hold up? And that's where the tension is, because you don't know. Will their little idea, their little scheme hold up? Will they have to, so that's where the tension is. It's kind of up here instead of, well, they're fighting and I guess they're going to win because Skullforge is a Dawn Treader and it's still got a few more islands to go.
Right.
I mean,
And it's amazing, like how cleverly they managed to do it, to totally fake the Lone Islanders out and Governor Gumpus, and totally spoil the bureaucracy, which I love that.
I'll just say the dialogue with Governor Gumpus, that might be my favorite man-to-man dialogue in the entire and all the Chronicles. I maybe seem kind of weird, but for some reason, there's just something really intriguing about it. I just love reading each line and just seeing how Caspian's kind of constantly boom, 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 boom.
Right.
Not only will you do this, but you'll do this, and not only, you'll have to pay out of your private purse.
Well,
That's an economic
see, he has
impossibility.
to pretend to be more confident than he is, and he has to
Yeah.
seem like he has it sewed together because the whole plan rests on that.
Yeah, and I just love that, and I think part of why I love it is, certainly, as just a character building point, this set, and this is maybe why we kind of had this as the really the first adventure. This sets up who Caspian is, because this is a different Caspian than in Prince Caspian.
Yes.
He's obviously a king here. He may still be young, inexperienced, all of that. But you look at this, you think, okay, this is obviously someone who rules a country.
Yes,
This is
I
not
agree.
someone who's constantly looking at someone else as a role model of how to rule a country, like he was with Peter in Prince Caspian. Not that that was a bad thing at the time, but that was the place he was in, and he's beyond
He's
that
manning
now.
up, and he's taking
Yeah.
responsibility. Oh, I just have to mention the part where they're at the slave market when Eustace can't get sold even for free. And I love what It says that, you know, Eustace looks sulky, for though no one would want to be sold as a slave, it is perhaps even more galling to be a sort of utility slave whom no one will buy, which shows you just how prideful Eustace is, that he was not sold, and that makes him upset, because what? What's wrong with me? Why wouldn't you want me? I love the end of this chapter. You know, Lewis can't go too long without mentioning Reepicheep. Reepicheep in so many ways, as we'll discuss.
I thought you were going to say food, but...
I guess that's sort of true as well.
Food and Reepicheep. The Chronicles of Food and Reepicheep. Sorry, continue.
Vern is trying to convince him to stay. The first reason Caspian gives is, I made an oath. But the second reason he gives is, and anyway, what could I say to Reepicheep?
Yeah.
And so, just reinforcing that Reepicheep is the one who's just so dying to go to the world's end. And Reepicheep always has such a presence in this story. And right after that, there's some great Reepicheep moments, like when he's playing chess, and he occasionally forgets he's playing chess, and he'll put a knight in danger, because that's what he would have done in its place.
And so, as Reepicheep said, it is after the Lone Islands that the adventure really begins, and we'll pick that up on our next episode.
And basically, the next episode is going to be a really long episode, really focused around the dragoning and undragoning. And so, if any of you have any, I would really encourage everyone to just read through that chapter where Eustace is a dragon, especially read through the undragoning. I always notice some little detail about the undragoning it just makes me pause and go, that's interesting, never thought about that. So I would encourage everyone, read through the undragoning and send in any questions or observations you have. Well, why does Lewis do this? Or what did Lewis mean by this? And I really want to have an extra long podcast next time. Just focus on the undragoning, since it is such a memorable, iconic, important scene in the Chronicles.
And also, if you have any thoughts, not just about the undragoning, but about Eustace, go ahead and send in questions about his transformation, if you have questions about his character development regarding this, because it's going to be kind of an undragoning and how it impacts Eustace combination. So a lot of discussion on Eustace's character will come in on that podcast.
I think it'll center around the undragoning, but we'll probably kind of turn into a Eustace character podcast at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to that. I could probably go for hours on just the undragoning. It's so interesting. I notice more things every time I read it. So looking forward to that. So please send in questions to rillian@narniweb.com and/or glumpuddle@narniweb.com. Looking forward to reading those.
Right.
So, in the next podcast, the adventure really begins.
Thanks again, Glumpuddle.
Bye.
Further up and further in.